This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hello, I'm Alex Smith. For the coming months, we added dozens of new college and community radio stations to this broadcast, at least 50 more stations. As you may know, Daphne Wisham and her Earthbeat radio crew are taking a break while they reorganize. Even while off duty, the reporter in Daphne never takes a break. Later in this program, you'll hear her on-the-spot recording from a tornado-ripped town in the hill country of Virginia. It's reality radio with a vision of what we can expect in the coming climate-damaged world. But we'll start with our feature interview. David Lochbaum is an American nuclear engineer, whistleblower, and expert for the Union of Concerned Scientists. Lochbaum warns reactor design and unreliable cooling systems, along with poor oversight, leave Americans with the same risk of multiple meltdowns experienced at Fukushima, Japan. We'll talk about how to make U.S. reactors safer for all of us. Then you get the latest from famous environmentalist Paul Watson, founder of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. You may believe in Gandhi. I do. Watson says nonviolence can never stop pirates of the sea. He saved seals, dolphins, turtles, sharks, and whales right from his early days in Greenpeace to Sea Shepherd's latest campaign in the Antarctic, where they risked their lives to stop Japanese whaling. Now Paul has become a policeman for small countries plundered by foreign fishing fleets. He's headed for Libya. I recorded Watson's speech following the premiere of a new full-length biofilm, Eco Pirate, The Paul Watson Story. Don't miss the lively questions from the enthusiastic audience. Meltdowns, storms, and ships crashing together on the high seas, this is Radio EcoShock. This is Alex Smith asking, what really happened at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear accident in Japan? Could a similar problem happen in American reactors? What have we learned from the Japanese disaster that could make all nuclear power plants more safe? It's so hard to get reliable information. Can we trust the government or nuclear plant operators? Our guest is a nuclear engineer with 17 years inside nuclear power plants. When he called out a safety problem in 1992, going all the way to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, David Lochbaum finally got one thing fixed at one plant. Since 1996, David has worked with the Union of Concerned Scientists as an expert in nuclear power safety. In 2009, he spent a year training nuclear operators in an NRC training center. All through the Fukushima nuclear disaster, David Lochbaum and the UCS provided the best independent assessments to the media. On May 13th, he testified to a congressional subcommittee, pointing out five key weaknesses in American reactor operation that must be fixed to reduce the chance of meltdowns in the U.S. David Lochbaum, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Alex.
David, I know you finally have the reports of the first few minutes of what happened after the Fukushima Daiichi was hit by that earthquake, but I would like to start with your testimony to Congress. I found it chilling. I couldn't believe we had so many weaknesses in the system. To start with, should we be confident that a similar accident just couldn't happen to an American reactor?
No, American reactors are basically the similar design. They're controlled by very similar regulations, and they face similar challenges to Fukushima. So while the exact scenario might be slightly different, there is a similar hazard that we need to address.
And in fact, there was a problem of a blackout that could have gone that way that you told Congress about. Could you tell us about that?
There was a incident back in June of 1998 where a tornado struck the Davis-Bessie nuclear plant outside of Toledo, Ohio. That tornado knocked the normal supply of power, the electrical grid, out. So the plant's emergency diesel generators automatically started and were providing electricity to the essential equipment needed to cool the reactor. This occurred in June when the outside air temperature was above 90 degrees. About 26 hours later, the room temperatures in where the diesel generators were operating heated up to the point where the diesel generators failed due to high temperatures. Fortunately, an hour earlier, the workers had been able to restore one of the off-site transmission lines, so they got power back to the plant just before the diesel generators failed. So fortunately, there was an overlap instead of a gap.
And how long can you have a blackout situation like that before the fuel rods melt and you go into meltdown?
Most of the reactors in the United States are designed for a blackout of 4 hours. 11 of our reactors, roughly 10%, are designed for a blackout lasting 8 hours, like Fukushima. When conditions last longer than that, then you start a meltdown clock that wasn't met at Fukushima. 3 reactors melted down. So you prefer not to beat the clock in that scenario.
So many of our, we're sort of getting into your testimony already, but many of our reactors in the United States do not even have, well, they have half the battery protection that was in the Japanese plant.
That's correct. The duration, whether you're a 4-hour plant or an 8-hour plant, is based on the severe weather conditions likely in the location of your plant, how reliable your backup generators are, and a number of other factors. And again, 93 of our 104 reactors are 4-hour plants, and only 11 are 8-hour plants. But, you know, even 8 hours wasn't enough for the reactors at Fukushima.
So what did you recommend to Congress?
Rather than anybody waving a magic wand and say you need X number of hours of battery capacity, what we recommended was look at each site individually and see how long it would take to get the cavalry there, replacement batteries or portable generators. If that time for the cavalry to show up, the replacements to show up, is less than your existing battery capacity, then you should be fine. However, if it takes longer to get the replacements there than your batteries will last, one of two things needs to happen. Either the battery capacity needs to be added, supplemented, so that there's not a gap, or safety equipment, replacement equipment, needs to be pre-staged closer to the site so that they can get there before the batteries are exhausted. So I don't think it's a one-size-all solution. It depends on the site and what resources are available to that site.
All right. Well, in your second point, David Lochbaum, you told Congress the plans for managing a severe accident are never checked by the NRC inspectors. Could you explain that?
Yeah, after the Three Mile Island accident, the NRC required plant owners to come up with severe accident management guides. So if an accident wanders off script and things get worse than the emergency procedures called for, there were severe accident management guidelines that were supposed to help the operators deal with those unexpected situations. The owners of nuclear power plants are required to have these severe accident management guidelines, but the NRC inspectors are required never to look at them. That's something the NRC's decided years ago. For a while, I was an instructor for the NRC, and I taught the severe accident management guidelines to NRC inspectors, but I prefaced every class by saying, you're not allowed to evaluate these at your respective sites. That needs to change. If you're going to take credit for them, we need to know now if they have missing steps or missteps, because it's too late during an accident to find out that the procedures you're following are flawed.
David, I was shocked at the amount of spent nuclear fuel and some live fuel at reactor number 4 at Fukushima Daiichi. That looked like a real problem. But apparently that's nothing compared to what is sitting around in American reactor spent fuel pools. What are the problems you outlined with the spent fuel handling when you talked to Congress?
Well, the spent fuel is a hazard. It's an unfortunate hazard. It's stored in wet pools that are up in the attics of that type of design, of which there are 31 similar reactors in the United States. In that design, there are no backup systems. There are no robust 4-foot-thick concrete walls around it. So there's an increased likelihood that you're going to have an accident because you don't have the same level of backup systems as the reactor core gets. In addition, if there is an accident in the spent fuel pool, there's a greater likelihood that the radioactivity released from it will go far and wide and put a lot of people in harm, because the spent fuel pool is not housed in a robust containment building like the reactor core is. To make it even worse, in many U.S. reactors, there's 10 times as much fuel in the spent fuel pool as in the reactor. So that's a hazard, an accident waiting to happen, and we need to do something to fix that.
And one of the somethings you suggested was that we put more into dry cask storage. Did that work at Fukushima where it was in dry cask storage?
Yeah, it's not discussed a lot, but there were about 400 fuel assemblies, irradiated fuel assemblies, spent fuel assemblies that were in dry cask at Fukushima. There's very little discussion of that because there's not a hydrogen explosion or it hasn't melted down. They don't have to dump water on it from helicopters. It's not 100% safe, but it's much, much safer than fuel that's stored in wet pools because there's not much that can go wrong. We have about 25% of the spent fuel in the United States is in dry cask. but 75% of it's not in dry cask yet. We need to accelerate the transfer of spent fuel into dry cask to lower both the security threat and also the safety threat from that storage.
And why don't plant operators do it? Is it just the expense?
The expense is part of it, but also, to be fair to the owners, they were told, in fact, they signed contracts with the federal government saying that the federal government would start taking that fuel in January of 1998. It's now more than 10 years later, and the government hasn't taken any of that fuel. So the owners made plans based on what their contracts with the federal government said, and then the federal government reneged. They're somewhat reluctant to spend a whole bunch of money to deal with an interim plan for 10 more years when it's a moving target. They don't know what the federal government, when and where they're going to take that fuel off their hands. So part of this is the federal government's inability to deal with the storage problem, the long-term storage problem.
For Radio EcoShock and EarthBeat, I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is David Lochbaum, an expert on nuclear power plant safety. We're looking into lessons from the triple meltdowns at Fukushima, Japan, to see how American operators could upgrade their own safety and protect all of the public. I know you were piecing together the first official charts and records, but can we start with your overview of what we now think really happened at that Japanese accident in the first critical hours and days? Let's spend a little time on that, if you will, and tell us, what do we know now?
Well, shortly after the earthquake occurred, the normal supply of electricity was lost to the Fukushima plant. There were three reactors operating at the time. The earthquake took away the normal supply of electricity. The reactors automatically shut down as designed when they detected ground motion caused by the earthquake. The emergency diesel generators, which are the backup supply of electricity for the plants, automatically started on all the units, and for the first 45, 46 minutes were providing power to the essential equipment needed to cool the reactor core. Then the tsunami arrived. The tsunami waters disabled the emergency diesel generators, which took away the backup supply of electricity to the plant, and that left the plant with only the power available from banks of batteries on each of the units. For units 2 and 3, there's a steam-driven system that's capable of being controlled by those batteries, and it appears that on units 2 and 3, that steam-driven system was being used to provide makeup water to the reactor core for cooling. Unit 1 was an older reactor and didn't have that system. It had what was called an isolation condenser instead. The isolation condensers are just very large tanks of water. Steam from the reactor is routed through metal tubes inside those large tanks of water. The steam gets cooled down, converted back into water, and then drains by gravity back into the reactor vessel. The operators put the isolation condensers on Unit 1 into service, but for some unexplained reason, when they did so, that caused the cool-down rate of the water inside the reactor to cool at a much faster rate than safety dictates. The water is inside a large tank or large metal pot called the reactor vessel, and to prevent the metal of the reactor vessel from breaking due to excessive expansion or contraction, you limit the heat-up rate and cool-down rate to 100 degrees Fahrenheit per hour. After the workers put the isolation condenser on Unit 1 in service, their cool-down rate was almost 300 degrees Fahrenheit per hour. So 11 minutes later, they took that system out of service and basically were left with no cooling on Units 1. When the batteries were depleted, basically all three reactor cores were left without cooling, and then it was only a matter of time before they overheated and melted.
And could you tell us just a little bit about the detailed reports that you've just received that you're going over?
About a week ago, TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, posted on their website a bunch of data from the reactors themselves. They put copies of the actual paper chart recorders, so they're in the control rooms. They put the printouts from the computer alarm typers. They put the operator logs, and they put some parameters plotted from high-speed data recorders, which are kind of like the black boxes for aircraft. They put all of that information, some 1,900 pages of information, on the TEPCO company's website. I spent a couple days going through that data, trying to evaluate what happened, when, and why. I previously, prior to going to work for UCS, I'd worked in the nuclear industry, and one of my jobs was to analyze events at plants using very similar data for very similar purposes.
I know these are still early days and you only have the beginnings of the information that you need, but so far, with your expertise in training nuclear operators for an accident, does it appear the TEPCO workers did the right things following the earthquake?
It did appear so. The available data only goes for the first 80 minutes, which is hours before the cores melted down. During that time period, it looks like the operators were following the emergency procedure scripts. They put cooling systems in service when they were supposed to do the functions that were necessary. As nature took more and more of those options away from them, they were left with fewer options to deal with the situation they had on hand. But in the period I looked at, it appears that the operators were doing what they were supposed to when they needed to do it.
And David Lochbaum, as you know, people living near reactors within earthquake zones in the United States are nervous, and I'm thinking of California, for example, or even in New York. Do you see any indications that essential equipment or the building itself was damaged by the earthquake rather than the tsunami?
That was actually one of the primary reasons for going through the data. We'd heard reports that some of the piping and some of the structures were damaged by the earthquake before the tsunami arrived. We didn't review every bit of data. That even though they put a large amount of data available, they didn't provide everything. But from the large amount of data we've reviewed so far, we don't see any signs that the structures or the piping failed before the tsunami arrived. I can't conclusively rule it out yet, but we don't see anything yet that points to that having happened.
And there have been theories as well that the building at Reactor 4 might have been damaged by the quake, or even that the fuel pool might have started leaking due to the quake rather than anything that happened during the tsunami. Any ideas on that one?
That's possible, but again, none of the data I've reviewed so far conclusively says that occurred. It still looks like the bulk of the damage was done when the hydrogen that collected inside the building exploded. There might have been damage before that, but I haven't seen anything yet that would allow me to swear to that.
Fair enough. Our guest is David Lochbaum from the Union of Concerned Scientists. David, most of the world was shocked when the Japanese authorities finally admitted 2 months after the accident that all three reactors had melted down at least within 48 hours of the quake and tsunami. Why did it take so long? And I have to say, too, surely the Japanese authorities and I think the American government and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, they must have known all along these reactors had melted down in the early days. What are your thoughts on that?
I think a number of reasons led to that delay. First of all, that when the tsunami hit and then the batteries were depleted, a lot of the instruments and the computers and the other things that collect data that would have made a post-event analysis easier to do were lost. Once the batteries were gone, all the computers, everything was dead. So their ability to piece together data, do the forensics to figure out what happened and why, was severely hampered by the data loss or data unavailability. Also point out that after the Three Mile Island accident melted down in 1979, it took the Americans almost 4 years to figure out that happened. They knew there was extensive fuel damage. That was known the first week. But it wasn't really known that the top half of the core had melted until a camera was lowered down from above and didn't see anything until it reached about 4 or 5 feet below where the top of the core had been. Then they found melted debris and a rubble bed where the core had been. And so it took us 4 years to figure out that Three Mile Island had melted down. So it's hard to fault the Japanese for taking 2 months to reach the same conclusion.
I'm still not reassured, I have to tell you. I've seen a report, I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of another American nuclear scientist who sent a report to the IAEA saying that by his calculations from what was known that the reactor must have melted down in at least one case. And, there's just been statements made by the Japanese to Korean television that all three reactors were punctured. They said that in late March. It just seemed like there was such a rosy view of it's not too bad and 55% of the fuel is still good and we can fix it. And there's a lot of distrust has built up for governments and nuclear plant operators out of this accident. So I don't want to go on and on about that, but what I would like to do is say, how can we make this better if an accident does happen in America? How can we know that we're getting transparency, that the public is getting informed what they need to know to protect themselves?
The one thing we that's done to try to address that issue is every 2 years, every nuclear plant in the country has to go through an emergency exercise where they simulate a very bad accident, and they evaluate how well the plant owner plus the local, state, and federal authorities would work together to protect the public from the consequences. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission comes in and evaluates or grades how well the plant owner deals with that situation. FEMA comes in and evaluates how well local, state, and federal authorities discharge their responsibilities. That exercise, that process isn't foolproof, but I think it does go a long ways towards getting people prepared for that day should it arrive. I'd like to circle back to one point about the Japanese. While they may have taken a while to figure out that the reactor core, or to publicly announce that the reactor cores had melted down, they actually took steps to evacuate people who were potentially in harm's way fairly early on. So it's not that they waited until they made that call before they took steps to protect the public. They ordered an evacuation out to 12 miles in the very early day or second day, very early on in the accident. So they weren't waiting for that meltdown paper, rock, scissor game to make those kind of calls.
Okay, well, we're starting to run out of time. I'm wondering what you would like to talk about. What would you like to tell our listeners?
Well, if we could get just one thing done in the fairly near term, I'd like to see the spent fuel pools, which are basically filled to overflowing, get the irradiated fuel transferred from the spent fuel pools into dry casks. That would significantly lower the safety and security threat at these plants. It's basically a no-brainer. We knew it before 9/11. It was emphasized after 9/11. It's resurfaced now after Fukushima. We really need to stop talking about that safety fix and actually implement it.
What kind of timeline would that take? Let's say that, everybody agrees that's what needs to be done. How long would it take to get to a safer level?
Bob Alvarez at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. issued a report just this past week that answered that question. He looked at it and estimated it would cost for the entire fleet of reactors in the United States approximately $3.6 billion and would take about a decade. He pointed out in his paper that $3.6 billion seems like a lot of money, but when you compare that to what Fukushima is paying for not having done that, it's a pretty cheap insurance.
Have you had any feedback from the NRC about whether the plants will be adding more battery power or whether more training will be put in as far as handling spent fuel pool accidents?
Right now, the NRC is in the middle of a two-phase approach to answering those questions. They've got their quick look, 90-day review, is due up in mid-July of this year, followed by a longer-term approach that's due sometime next year. It already looks like they're seeing that there are issues involved with both backup power sources and with spent fuel storage. It looks like those issues will be addressed in some form or manner. But I think there's many more lessons: emergency planning, communications. There was a disconnect between what the U.S. recommended for U.S. citizens around the plants. They evacuated out to 50 miles. The Japanese only evacuated out to 12 and then 19 miles. So I think there's some collateral issues that need to be resolved, some within our borders, some we have to work with our international partners.
Thank you so much. Our guest has been David Lochbaum. He's an experienced nuclear plant engineer. He's worked in U.S. nuclear plants. He was a safety whistleblower, and he has been the director of Nuclear Safety Project for the Union of Concerned Scientists. Get more reliable and expert information from their website at www.uscusa.org. David, we really appreciate all the work you've done for the public. It has been super, and thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you, Alex, for having me on.
The question of whether the earthquake damaged the Fukushima Daiichi reactors is critical for U.S. reactors and American-designed reactors around the world. The Japanese press carried stories quoting plant operators TEPCO saying critical reactor piping may have broken in the actual quake and not in the following tsunami. This was reported by Kyoto May 26th. Why does that matter? If true, it means any nuclear power plant could melt down due to an earthquake without a tsunami. For example, the Indian Point reactor north of New York City, which is on a fault line but away from the sea. Or the El Diablo reactors in California, which claim to be too high for a tsunami to hit. A large part of the world nuclear industry would be at risk. At a press conference, TEPCO said pipes leaking right after the earthquake could explain sudden temperature changes in reactors 1 and 3. In our interview, David Lochbaum, poring over 1,900 pages of data in just 2 days, does not yet see evidence of this. David does not say quake damage is not possible, but he hasn't seen convincing evidence so far. It really is too early to tell. Hardly any on-site inspections have been done because workers cannot even approach the reactor buildings. Heavy rains, sure to come with more tropical storms, may cause yet another disaster for the sea. Finally, radiation is flowing everywhere in that region of Japan. Even the snow and river fish are now testing as highly radioactive. This nuclear nightmare is happening so fast it can hardly be measured, be known, or be understood. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock and Earthbeat. I'm Alex Smith, trying to fill your ears for the planet and for coming generations. If you are new to this space, keep in mind we are filling in for that fine American green news program, Earthbeat, while Daphne Wysham and her crew reorganize. After 8 years on the air, Daphne deserves a break, but we need her back as one of America's top environmental reporters for nonprofit radio. Keep in touch with the website, earthbeatradio.org. Many of us are graduates from the Greenpeace School of Nonviolent Environmental Action. Paul Watson came from the Canadian Coast Guard to help the earliest Greenpeace anti-whaling campaigns. He put himself between harpoons and the gentle giants. He stood with the visionary Greenpeace founder Bob Hunter in front of a moving icebreaker off Canada's east coast to stop that infamous seal hunt. Watson became frustrated, wanting to go further. Bearing witness in the Quaker tradition was not enough, he said. Here is my report from the opening of a new film about his life and adventures at the far edge of environmentalism.
I'll do everything I can to protect whales and the other beings in the ocean. Not for people, but for them.
What would you do to save the animals and the ecosphere? How far would you go? Paul Watson says humans are a violent and dangerous species. The environmentalist and early founder of Greenpeace in Vancouver went to the edge of violence to save seals, dolphins, and especially the whales from human slaughter. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock and Earthbeat. I've just seen the premiere of a new film biography, Eco-Pirate, The Story of Paul Watson. We see young Paul on a dying whale, standing pat in front of an advancing icebreaker, ramming a rogue whaling ship and taking on the Japanese whaling fleet year after year in harsh Antarctic waters. Writer and director Trish Dolman spent years on the ships of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. She includes the harshest critics in her film, making this the definitive biography of one of the Earth's greatest environmentalists. Let's get straight to Paul's update on the new Sea Shepherd actions, his good news for whales, and the lively Q&A with a wildly supportive audience in Vancouver, Canada, where the man started his 40-year voyage for the Earth's defenseless creatures. This is Paul Watson and Trish Dolman, recorded by Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock and Earthbeat Radio at the Projecting Change 2011 Film Festival, May 27th.
Well, I know everyone wants to hear Paul talk, but I just want to say a couple things because there's a couple more people I want to thank. Leah Mallon, who's in the audience, worked on the film, helping me develop it early on. And then I really need to thank my producer, Kevin Eastwood, who's not here tonight. He's actually working on another show for Animal Planet called Animal Hoarders, so he's running around the States, but he tirelessly worked on this film for the last 3.5 years, and it really did take a village of people to make it. So one of the things for me that about making the film, it's been a great honor to actually be able to interview some of the giants of the environmental movement, obviously Paul, but Paul Spong, Rex Weiler, all these people who, you know, created incredible change starting in the 60s and 70s. And one of the greatest moments for me was being on the ship. And it really dawned on me when we were patrolling the Galapagos that the oceans are a vast place. And I think because humans are land mammals, we tend to think that people are following regulations. And it was like a light bulb going on, knowing that they're pretty lawless. And Paul is a unique individual in the world doing the work he does. So thanks, Paul.
Thanks. Just wanted to update. This year we went back down with three ships, and this was our most effective year ever. The Japanese whaling fleet took only 15% of their quota, and they left a month and a half earlier than expected, and I don't think they're going to come back. But if they do, we'll be back there waiting for them. Meanwhile, the Steve Irwin is in southern France. We replaced the Adigil with a new vessel, which we named Gojira, which means Godzilla. Godzilla, actually, Gojira means in Japanese gorilla whale, so we thought it was quite appropriate. I just couldn't resist the headlines of Godzilla chases whaling fleet out of Antarctica. You know, in Japan, of course, Gojira in Japan has a completely different meaning. But unfortunately, the only thing more frightening than Godzilla is Godzilla's lawyers. And so we were told we couldn't use the name, but that's okay. It fulfilled its function. And then 2 days ago, we just renamed the vessel, so it's now the Brigitte Bardot, and gave us a terrific media coverage in France there 2 days ago. So the Brigitte Bardot is with the Steve Irwin in Toulon, and in a couple of days, we'll be leaving to go to the coast of Libya. And the reason being is that the poachers are going to take advantage of the war zone, and the EU has assured us that any fishing vessel we find in that zone, we can cut their nets and free the fish, that any fishing vessel is illegal. Now, last year we cut the nets and released 800 tuna, and when people are concerned about our safety this year, it's much safer this year than it was last year. First of all, no Libyan Air Force. Second of all, no Libyan Navy. We just have to worry about friendly fire from NATO, but we'll keep them advised as to where we are. And right after that, we will be taking the vessels to the International Whaling Commission meeting this year, which is in July, and it's being held in Jersey, in the Isle of Jersey. And then from there, we'll be going up to the Danish Faroe Islands to interfere with the killing of pilot whales there. Also, we've had a crew in Japan for the last 6 months, and they succeeded in cutting the dolphin kill quota by half. 800 dolphins were killed this year, but 800 were killed, but every year it's usually about 1600 to 1800. So, you know, but that was a 6 month crew on the ground for 6 months. And in fact, we almost lost them because on March, I think the 12th, our crew were in of all the days to go to the northern part of the island to check out dolphin killing. They were in Iwate Prefecture when our crew leader noticed the water being sucked out of the harbor. And they got up on top of a hill just in time, and 9 minutes later, the tsunami wiped out that entire town. And we lost them for about 40 hours, but in true Sea Shepherd fashion, the next morning they commandeered a Japanese fire truck and drove their way down the hill. Unfortunately, Japan has it treats us really as like, it's almost an honor, really. They treat us like we're a foreign nation that they're at war with. And they've been putting a lot of pressure on it. I'm now officially, by the way, on the Interpol blue list. What that means is I'm not wanted for anything, but people are instructed to give me a hard time when I cross borders. And I first learned about this when I drove from here down to Washington. And I happen to hold both passports, so they can't keep me out of the U.S., can't keep me out of Canada, much of the frustration in both countries. But as I drove down across the border, I just calmly handed my passport over, not suspecting anything, and suddenly the officer said, "Put your hand on the wheel now, sir." And all of a sudden, sirens started going off, and my hands are on the wheel, and I noticed that there was guys behind concrete blocks with guns aimed at me. And they said, "Throw out your keys." "Well, I can't throw out my keys with my hands on the wheel." So then he got me out of the car, handcuffed me, threw me in, and 10 minutes later I was on my way, because apparently there's no warrant for my arrest. But what I found out is that I'm on the document as armed and dangerous eco-terrorist. Now, what we've managed to do, I've managed to make this work for me now, so that just yesterday coming into Chicago, we call ahead now and everything gets cleared, but I'm met at the airport by the Homeland Security guys, who I know now and very friendly, and they escort me right to the front of the line and out the door. I'm out there before everybody else, so I'm getting the VIP. I call it the blue list VIP treatment, and so very thankful to Japan for that. But anyway, Hopefully we won't have to go back. And we're actually making other progress. Right after that, I was invited by the president to Palau to come visit him in March. And we were requested if we could help them. And so we said, yeah, we'll provide our vessel, the Bob Barker. We'll take it and send it to Palau to police their waters, because all of these island nations are getting just completely plundered by illegal fishing operations. There's more illegal fishing in the world now than there is legal fishing. And so we agreed, and we signed a contract with the Palau government to officially police their waters. Well, Japan found out about that. They sent a delegation. Despite the earthquake and the tsunami, they still sent a delegation down there to demand that Palau not work with us. And, of course, the president didn't give in on this, but then they said, well, we'll give you a patrol boat and the money to run it. And so the president called me. I said, well, take the patrol boat and take the money. That's great. You know, so which he did, and now we're going to Nauru and the Cook Islands and the Marshall Islands. I think we can get Japan to provide patrol boats to everybody this way. So thank you. We'd be very pleased to answer any questions anybody has.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock and Earthbeat. You've just heard Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society and director Trish Dolman following the premiere of the new film Eco Pirate, The Story of Paul Watson. Let's go straight to the question and answer period in Vancouver.
All right, questions right here.
Thank you for your remarkable work. I wonder how we can use some of the same techniques you've used for marine mammals to protect all species in global warming. What kinds of exciting, important, revolutionary techniques do you think we can use there?
I think the really what you need to concentrate on is that the solution to all these problems lies in the passion, the courage, and the imagination of individuals, and not to depend on governments. They never solve problems, they cause problems, but to depend upon that kind of passion. And just imagination is really the way to find out about it, or to find these solutions. When people say that, it's so overwhelming, I mean, what can we do? I mean, it's impossible. Well, I think that the answer is always the impossible one. You just have to be able to visualize that answer. For instance, in 1972, the very idea that Nelson Mandela would be president of South Africa was unthinkable, unimaginable, and impossible, yet it happened. So I think we can solve these problems, and that's why I take an optimistic outlook on this.
Next question.
In the film, you said there was a question of your retiring. What's your comment on that?
Well, first of all, I've never, ever believed in retirement. My grandfather, my mother's father, died at 96, and he was murdered. So he was working till the day he died. He still managed to wound the guy enough that he was arrested. So I don't believe in retirement, and I don't intend to retire. In fact, I'm quite enjoying what I'm doing. And I don't know, people seem to think I'm getting old or something. That question keeps coming up all the time. I'm not that old. I'm the youngest founding member of Greenpeace.
How old are you?
Well, in December I turned 60.
He won't retire. Having been on the ships, I don't think Paul will ever retire.
In the year 2000, when the tsunami hit Southeast Asia, the Canadian government financed the rebuilding of fish boats in Sri Lanka. And the Canadian press, when the tsunami hit Japan a couple of months ago, it was considered to be unethical to raise the issue that this was some kind of karma that was due to them. Maybe you'd like to comment on that.
Oh, no, the earthquake and the tsunami in Japan were not karma. It's a question of geography and geology. And so I actually get very upset when people say the Japanese deserve this. It's not the Japanese people. It's just like, you know, you and I are not responsible for the seal hunt as Canadians, just as the average Japanese is not responsible for the killing of whales and the killing of dolphins. It's a certain segment of these societies. And ultimately it falls on the government. In this country, the single most corrupt and probably ridiculous bureaucracy in this country is the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. They are totally incompetent. They
They destroyed the cod fishery on the East Coast, and they will wipe out the salmon on the West Coast. These people are environmental criminals. And, you know, they're always saying, oh, well, we have the best scientists in the world. You know, they have the best biostitutes in the world. These are people who come up with the scientific justifications for their political policies. And that, you know, and they're wrong. They've been wrong consistently. Well, you know, I hate to say that. As long as this country keeps voting for like Stephen Harper, then it's all going to go down the tube. That man is an ecological criminal. You know, today that we dropped $100,000 bombs on Libya, what the hell is Canada thinking?
Any more questions? Follow that one. Oh, here we go. It's getting fired up.
Hi, Paul. I would like to just preface this real fast. I ran for the Pirate Party Canada in Vancouver Center during this last election. I was asked by a reporter, is there somebody who you'd want to be? And I said, well, I don't want to be anybody. I want to be Travis McCrae, but I would like to have Paul Watson say one day, you know that Travis McCrae is a pretty good guy. And I'm also, Peter just told me that I'm probably going to be the communications officer on one of your ships. I have no problem dying in your name, or, you know, in the name of, not in your name, but in the name of the environment under your command.
You ran for Vancouver Center?
Yes, I did.
You and I have that in common. I ran for MP for Vancouver Center. We both lost.
So, now, my real question is, I've noticed that, especially with a lot of the young people, we don't have balls anymore. I mean, I think that's it. I mean, people are not standing up and going out and standing up for what they believe in as much as they used to. At least, you know, I look at the videos of the 60s and everybody going out. Okay, what is your opinion on that?
I disagree completely. I mean, if it wasn't for the passion and the courage of the individuals that crew my ships, we wouldn't be able to do anything. And I've got 2,000 crew applications right now, more than we've ever had. And the hardest part of my job on that is saying no to so many people. You know, we don't want to, but we just don't have the room. This last campaign to Antarctica was 88 crew from 23 different nations on 3 different ships. And these are the people who make our organization effective. And I'm seeing more and more young people getting involved, more so, I would say, than in the 70s or the 80s. So I completely take a different view on that, really. I think that there's a much more involvement, and I'm very optimistic about that.
Can I just add to that, too? I think it's the world's changed. I mean, people used to take to the streets perhaps more visibly than people do now, and that was more effective then, and the world has changed and become much more sophisticated. So now I think there's far more room for people and young people to use the internet, to use YouTube, to use all these things that didn't exist 30 years ago to spread a social message. And I think there's lots of people doing that are inspired by people like Paul and Sea Shepherd. So it's just different. The playing field is different.
One of the things that, you know, we're constantly criticized because of the way we do things and everything. But the reality of it is that in the entire history of our organization, we've never injured anybody. We've never had anybody seriously injured. We've never actually committed a felony or been convicted of a felony crime. You know, 2 years ago, I was invited to give a lecture to the FBI Academy in Quantico, of all things, and they actually paid me to come lecture the FBI. And one of the FBI agents said, well, you know, Sea Shepherd's walking a pretty damn fine line when it comes to the law. And I said, well, who cares how fine it is as long as you don't cross the line. So they couldn't disagree with that logic. Well, one of them said, well, you know, people come into Sea Shepherd and they learn how to be eco-terrorists. You know, there's some of your ex-crew members have gone on to be eco-terrorists, whatever that is. I don't think they're working for British Petroleum, but anyway, but I said, so how am I responsible for what people do when they leave Sea Shepherd? You train them, you're responsible. I said, okay, I have 3 names for you. Lee Harvey Oswald, Timothy McVeigh, and Osama bin Laden. You trained them. You're responsible. Actually, 3 of them joined. I don't know if that's to keep tabs on us or not.
Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Love you.
Thanks.
Do you still live in Gig Harbor?
Never did live in Gig
Harbor.
Oh,
Friday Harbor. Are you still there?
About 2 weeks a year.
Oh, well, that's true. Well, you're our national treasure. despite DFO. Where do we stand on the seal hunt, or the sea shepherd stance on the seal hunt? It's a real black mark on our country.
The Canadian seal hunt, for all intents and purposes, is over. There's no market. Europe has banned the seal pelts. Are banned. China just banned seal pelts. But Canada just can't let it go. So this idiot who runs DFO, Gail Shea, she just set the quota at 460,000, the highest quota in the history of the seal hunt. Absolutely ridiculous. What was that all about? Thumbing their nose at Europe. It's a bunch of kindergarten guys in there just fighting with each other. It's ridiculous. But how many seals are going to be killed this year? Maybe 50, 60,000, which is a lot, but still a lot less the quota because there's no money in it. We have effectively destroyed the market, and that is the only language anybody understands, is profit and loss. Now, the one thing, the government wants us to go back in there, but we're not doing it because they know that if we go back in there, it will just rile up everybody and all this national patriotism and everything, and let's go kill a seal in order to piss off Sea Shepherd. We're not going to do it. The seal hunt is dying, and we're going to let it die. Now we're going to turn our attentions to trying to stop the slaughter of seals in Namibia. So that's what we'll be doing for now. But I think that within a couple of years, it'll die out a natural death. After, you know, and they will no longer have seal stew in the parliament buildings, and Harper won't be walking around with a silly little sealskin briefcase and everything. You know, and you don't have the governor general eating raw seal hearts on television like, you know, some sort of barbarian princess. I mean, the thing is getting... You know, Canada's just been really crazy on this, but I think we'll grow up.
I just want to add one thing to that. I cut about an hour out of the film that was all about the seal hunt, because at one time it was much, much longer. But two things. Elizabeth May said that she felt that the seal hunt was the biggest distraction away from the decimation of the cod fishery, and that's why the Canadian government pursues it, is to keep both fisher people and activists focused on the seal hunt and not thinking about or focusing their attention on the decimation of one of the greatest fish species on the planet, which I thought was very astute. And then I was interviewing a guy who's in charge of PR for the DFO about the seal hunt. And when I asked him, I said, well, don't you see that the role of activists, because they're, you know, vociferously against people like Paul or anyone who opposes a seal hunt, and in fact kind of hate them. And I said, well, don't you see that the social function of an activist is to create change, to create social change, and that activists have actually caused you to change your approach to the seal hunt and try to make it more humane. Otherwise, you never would have cared, because now they run around saying, well, it's humane, it's humane. And the guy turned to me, he goes, you know, I never actually thought of that way. And that, to me, was one of the reasons why I wanted to make this film, is I think people have forgotten the importance of and the social function of activists like Paul Watson. So
one conversation that we had out on the ice with the Coast Guard actually was very funny. I said to the Coast Guard, what are you doing out here? And he says, well, we're protecting the fishermen from people like you, sir. I said, well, who's protecting the seals? And the guy came back and he said, I understand that's your job, sir.
On that note, Paul, thank you very much. Trish, thank you very much, both of you guys.
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah, absolutely, one more thing.
I'd just like to say that I'd like to just recognize the one person who means more to me than anybody else and who has stood by me, and that's my daughter, Lily Alani. Thank you.
And if I can just say a few words on behalf of the festival, thank you guys so much for being here. And I just really want to ask you guys for your support, because organizations like Projecting Change provide the platform for Trish to bring her movies here to share with all of you guys. Sea Shepherd is there for you guys to support so they can save the animals. So please get involved. Get on the Sea Shepherd website, The Projecting Change. Come out and see more films, support more filmmakers, so that we can support more eco-terrorists. All right? So take care, guys.
That was Paul Watson, founder and captain of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, with Trish Dolman, writer and director of the new film, Eco Pirate, The Story of Paul Watson. This full-length movie will be released in July. Find links in my blog at ecoshock.info or at screensiren.ca. This was, hands down, the best green documentary I've seen this year. The Arctic footage and shipboard life alone was stunning. Writer Dolman did not create a fan film. She went to Watson's critics, and there are many, from the Japanese ambassador through Canadian officials, even to wives and a daughter left behind on shore. The story of early Greenpeace is woven in, with a careful look at nonviolence versus direct action. There is love and danger when ships collide in the open seas, and you are there as part of the crew. In the end, despite criticism and doubts, admiration for Paul Watson cannot be denied. Certainly the living marine mammals he saved would vote for his life of activism, which incidentally never cost a human life. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock and Earthbeat. I recorded this event at the Projecting Change 2011 Film Festival in Vancouver, Canada, on May 27th. Find out more at ecoshock.info. There is no copyright on this work. Spread it around. Be sure and check out the movie Eco Pirate when it comes out. And find out more about Paul Watson at seashepherd.org. If you are just tuning in, you'll get double time today. This is Radio EcoShock and Earthbeat. Host Daphne Wysham is taking a break while she and her valiant crew reorganize the program. I'm Alex Smith filling in. Even while off duty, Daphne couldn't help hauling out her recorder and her reporter's instincts when she drove through the demolished town of Glade Springs, Virginia last week. It was a month after one of the hundreds of killer tornadoes that swept through America from Oklahoma all the way north to the Canadian border. As we heard from Weathermeister Jeff Masters last week, we still don't have enough data to know if this year's record rash of tornadoes was triggered by climate change. It looks suspicious, and scientists predicted stronger storms, but the whole science isn't in yet. What I do know, this is the kind of continuing weather damage we will see from an unstable atmosphere as we continue to pour greenhouse gases into a sensitive atmosphere. That is what the science says. More record flooding, more out-of-control wildfires, and stronger storms will rip the roof off the homes and dreams of millions of people all over the world. Is America a rich country, or is it bankrupt? If you get hit by climate disruption, can you expect the government to help? Let's see who really shows up with this on-the-spot recording of just one grandmother, Rita Muncy, who thought her family was safe. Here's Daphne Wysham reporting from Virginia.
My name is Daphne.
I'm Rita Muncy. We're in Glade Spring, Virginia.
Glade Spring, Virginia. Now, we're sitting outside of your house here next to Highway 81. Can you tell me how long ago did this tornado hit?
April 28th. It's been 4 weeks now.
And what is the structural damage to your house?
Our roof has to be totally replaced, our siding, our gutters, 13 windows, and inside our ceilings are coming down, our walls are cracked.
Tell us what it was like when the tornado actually struck.
It's the worst thing I've ever seen or heard or lived through my whole life.
What was it like?
It was a loud noise. We barely made it to the basement in time with three small children, and we got there about 20 seconds to spare, and I could hear everything thumping and that loud sound like a whistle. I could hear it, and I told my son, I said, "There goes the house, boys," and I just knew when we came out that it would be gone. But
now
it's standing.
Is this your granddaughter here?
Yes, this is their youngest one. This is Evelyn.
And she's about...
She's two. Yep.
So your neighbor's house is completely destroyed. The roof is completely off of it. Trees are cut in half. Devastation all around. How many homes in this neighborhood have been destroyed? Do you know?
About 95% of our homes are destroyed or gone.
95%?
Yes.
What did your local government do when this happened?
Well, we applied for our FEMA aid, and we were assured by our governor, help is coming. But we were denied our FEMA aid.
What was the rationale for denying the FEMA aid?
They said there was not enough structural damage.
To your house in particular, or to everybody's house around here?
To everyone. Glade Springs did not have enough structural damage for FEMA assistance.
And what has been the response of local elected officials to that?
Oh, they say that we are appealing it. We have had protests in front of Congressman Griffith's office. He came out and gave us a big old pep talk that it was being appealed and that he was with us, but that's as far as it's gone.
Have you ever seen weather like this here before?
Never. In fact, I always told my kids we were safe here because we had the mountains to protect us. And now we just don't have that protection, I guess.
So how are you managing here? I mean, you've got, I just drove through a rainstorm and very heavy rainstorm at that. How are you managing here in this house?
Well, like I said, we've got a roof tarped. Every time it rains, more water comes in on our ceilings. We spent an hour in the basement yesterday because they said there was more tornado warnings. And then another day this week, we were an hour in the basement. We're petrified.
Do you own this house?
Us and the mortgage company.
So what are your plans in terms of insurance?
Well, our insurance guy is trying to give us about a third of what we need to put our house back together. And we're fighting them. That's all we know to do is just keep fighting.
So your hope is that if you get a third of your insurance, a third of the value of your home from your insurance and the rest, you're hoping will come from FEMA? Is that your hope?
We're praying that FEMA will. But let me tell you, the volunteers that have came through here, I guess FEMA's turned their back on us. So everybody in our community has really pitched in to come and help. There's volunteers, carpenters that have come around, and they keep saying that as soon as you find out what your insurance is going to do, call us, let us know. We will come and work for free. Anything we can do to help you get your house back. So, you know, there's seven people living here, and we don't need their ceiling falling in on our grandbabies.
Are these carpenters that are volunteering to come and help, are they from the local community?
Yes, a lot of them are. A lot of them are from, like, Elizabethton, Blountville, about an hour away, Gate City, the churches, Red Cross, the United Way. Mm-hmm. They have came, got volunteers from Eastman yesterday, and they cut my next-door neighbor's stubs of trees down and helped pick up some of the garbage in her yard. Mm-hmm. They've just been wonderful.
So what's your message then to FEMA and to the federal government in response to what you're living through?
Okay, I am living through one of my worst nightmares in my whole life. And we pay our taxes every single year, as we're supposed to. Our government sends billions of dollars to foreign countries. I want FEMA to come in here and take care of us here at home. As it should be.
Any thought on what you're going to do if they don't?
You know what? We just keep praying every day. If FEMA doesn't help, I'm just the generosity of the local people. That's about all we can do. Just pray.
Well, thanks for talking with us today. Tell me your name one more time.
I'm Rita Muncy.
Thanks for talking with us today, Rita Muncy.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was Daphne Wisham, longtime host of Earthbeat Radio from the blown downtown of Glade Springs, Virginia, in late May 2011. For me, that clip is much more than disaster entertainment. It contains almost everything I've tried to communicate on this show, except maybe Rita Muncy says it better, being there in the moment, with children to shelter, poor, in the middle of such a rich country. My heart goes out to all the people who now fear the sky and the power of nature. My conclusion? If the unstable climate finds you, don't expect government help. Your local community volunteers are the folks who really show up. Maybe it's time to join the transition movement, form a community support group near you, and build those relationships that will help you and your family through the hardest of times. The websites are earthbeatradio.org and ecoshock.org. Please contact your local college and community radio station calling for true green news and analysis. Support this program. And we'll keep it coming, advertising free and just plain free. I'm Alex Smith. We live in challenging times, don't we? Join us next week. Thank you for using your ears, mind, and heart.